Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for High Velocity Radio.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. Stone Payton Lee Cantor here with you this afternoon, guided by our fearless producer, Miss Katie Galley. Lee, this is going to be a fantastic segment. We've been looking forward to this for such a long time. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast speaker, author, in fact, the author of the book that got on our radar that we became so enamored with, Profit First. But he's also authored other books, consults to organizations and executives all around the world. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Mike Michalowicz. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Lee and Stone.
Well, Mike, as Stone mentioned, Profit First got on our radar, and it kind of became a, I don't want to use the word Bible, but it has been a very important book. It has been a very important book for us, and we use the techniques in the book. But can you share a little bit about how the book came about and how you came up with kind of reverse engineering a better way to maybe do accounting?
Yeah, so I'm an entrepreneur myself, and what I discovered in my own business, and now subsequently discovered is true for almost all business, is that we follow a foundational formula that sales minus expenses equals profit, yet it fails almost all businesses. Over 80, some say up to 85% of businesses are surviving check by check. And I investigated, and the reason is there's nothing wrong logically with that formula of putting profit last, but there's a extraordinary behavioral impact. It becomes the last consideration. Many businesses wait till, you know, year end and say, was it profitless year? No, dang, well, maybe next year. And we keep on delaying the consideration of profit. So what I did with Profit First is I simply flipped the formula. So it's sales minus profit equals expenses. And the impact is, I think, pretty extraordinary behaviorally, because what we do is when money comes into our business, we immediately take a predetermined percentage, 5, 10, 15%, whatever, and allocate that money toward profit. And when the money is allocated toward profit, we now have to run our business off the remainder. It's basically the pay yourself first principle applied to business.
Now, when you're working with clients and helping them, or when they find the book and they implement this, what are some of the kind of challenges that they run into? Is it hard for them to define like what percentage should I call profit, or like kind of the ratios in this?
Yeah, I mean, the first challenge they run into is they say, well, this won't work for me. My business is unique. There is no profit in our industry. And how I address that, I say, well, that's like looking at the industry and determining where your business should be is like telling your kids, hey, let's figure out what the class average is and let's aspire to be that. What we tell our children is be the most of yourself, be the best of who you are. And this is true for every business. Regardless of what industry you're in, there's a profit opportunity and you can be the best of yourself. Other people say, but Mike, I've never been profitable. And now you're telling me to take my profit first. I can't take my profit first until I'm profitable. And my argument in that case, I said, well, what formula have you been following to this point? They said, well, the traditional formula, profit's the bottom line. I said, well, you said it's not worked for you. You haven't been profitable. Maybe it's time to give up what's not working for you. Once I can get people past those two barriers, then they're willing to get started. And this is the last step. To be successful with Profit First is not to dive into a large amount of profit. Don't take 5 or 10 or 15 or 20% if you've never taken any profit in the past. Let's start at 1%, build that profit muscle, and over time build 2, 3, 4, and then get to the percentages that you aspire to have for your business.
Do people confuse profit and what they pay themselves?
Yes. So those are two distinct things. I believe a business owner should have what I call owner's compensation, which is your lifestyle account. This is a regular stream of income that your business gives you to support your lifestyle. Profit is a reward above and beyond your lifestyle. This is that bonus. If we were looking at a public company, you may own public stock. I own Ford shares. Ford sends out a quarterly profit distribution. I don't work for Ford, but they sent me a reward for being a shareholder. I took on risk. The company's value could go up, but it could also decline. So they reward me. Well, a small business does the same thing. You took on extraordinary risk of starting a business. A profit is a reward for being a risk taker. The bonus comes out quarterly, I suggest. And the owner's compensation is your regular compensation to support your lifestyle for being an employee within the business.
Now, when you're working with firms that are small to mid-sized firms and maybe don't have a lot of employees, do you recommend sharing these numbers in a public manner like some employee-owned businesses do?
Yeah, we actually do at my company. It depends on your style, but I found when you have open books, and we share everything, including our profits, that now the employees have two things happen. One is they have a reasonable understanding of how the business performs. Many employees, particularly for small business, think the owner is a multimillionaire sits on a yacht smoking cigars all the time. And the reality for many small businesses is the owner is making very little to no income and is washing yachts and taking cigar stains out of yachts as a side job to make a living. So when we show the numbers to our employees, they get a realistic understanding of what the costs are to run and sustain a business. But the second thing is they also become invested in the successfully increasing profitability when they're sharing in profits. Literally, as an example, our colleagues, I have a small business, 8 employees. My colleagues all share in the profit. My assistant who schedules my travel as I do my speaking tours, I will speak at fancy hotels, yet she will put me up in a Holiday Inn because it's more profitable for the business. And that's exactly the behavior I want. She wins, I win, the business wins.
Now, that sounds good when the company is profitable. Does it work as well if the company is struggling and the employees see that there's not a lot of money coming in? How does the fear element and people's desire for security come into play in this?
Yeah, so you have to be very tactful in that situation. If you're in dire straits, I suggest delaying the disclosure of everything. I believe in being integral. Emily Dickinson said a great thing, speak the truth, but with slant. Meaning, be integral. You can't lie to our employees, but we don't want to scare the bejesus out of them so that they flee and run away. So when your business is first trying to achieve profitability, tell your employees, hey, we're trying some new actions to increase profitability. And over time, we're going to introduce parts of it when we're ready to the rest of the team so you can fully embrace this. But in that case, I would roll it out slowly and tactfully.
Can you talk a little bit about your career? Because I know, I guess publicly, you started Toilet Paper Entrepreneur was your first online venture.
Yeah. So before that, I was a full-time entrepreneur before I ever became an author. Toilet Paper Entrepreneur was one of the books I wrote, and that became a business. But I was in the computer space. So I had businesses in computer networking. I actually had a business that conducted computer crime investigation. And that was acquired by a Fortune 500, actually. And what happened in my early stages as I started these businesses and I had sold 2 of them, my ego took over. I thought I was a genius. I'm not. I thought I knew all the answers to entrepreneurship. I sure as heck did not. And went into becoming an angel investor. And I lost tremendous amounts of money, all my money, in fact, being an angel investor. And as painful as that was, in retrospect, I'm now grateful for that period because it got my ego back in check, hopefully permanently. But it also made me realize I know nothing about entrepreneurship. I was in the right place at the right time. Luck played in. But I didn't understand the formulas for success. And that's when I started writing books. The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur was my first book into exploring what I didn't know. And actually, all the books, Profit First included, are books I've written, quite frankly, to fix my own ways and hopefully serve many other people in the process.
Now, I'm in the middle right now of the pumpkin plan, and that talks about, if you want to build a big or have a big pumpkin, you have to kind of focus on the seeds of the big pumpkin and then kind of weed out everything else. Are you still finding that accurate in your work as you diversify?
Oh, yeah. So the pumpkin plan, I wrote that about organic, healthy, and explosive growth. I've used that method for all my past businesses, and I use it today, and it works. One of the core principles in there, which is an adage that goes around entrepreneurship, is the riches are, in fact, in the niches. So in every business I have been involved in, including today, I always look for the niche community to serve. Secondarily, I line it up with my purpose. I want to make sure that I get joy and satisfaction at what I do. And when I'm serving a very specific community and getting joy in the process, inevitably, that's a business position to do very well.
And when you're working with companies starting out, do they don't want to miss out on any clients, so they want to kind of cast a wide net.
Right.
You see that a lot?
Yeah. I see that all the time, right? So the early stages of the business, and I argue you do have to cast a wide net in the very beginning stages because your assumptions may not come true. The problem is then we believe this is the way to grow a business. So we keep on taking a more and more diverse set of clients on. And it's usually backed by illogical logic saying, you know, there's safety and diversification, which I actually don't believe in. There's massive risk because it slows down or prevents growth. But when we, and with the analogy I use in the pumpkin plan is you'll never drive by a country road on a country road past some field and miraculously see a massive pumpkin just growing out of an ordinary field. And the reason you won't is because it requires that all the nutrients, the water, the effort of the farmer is spread out to serve everything. And that's what happens with business. When we diversify, it's spreading out our attention, our energy, our money, and therefore it actually prevents the growth of anything colossal. So in the beginning, I think you have to diversify to find what's working. But once you find what's working, declare that as your niche, become masterful in those expertise in serving that community, and then the explosive growth will spark.
Now, how do you know if the niche is niche-y?
So, ironically, I have a formula for it. I find that if I have upwards of about 20,000 prospects in a niche, but not much more than that, that I think I have, and this is mostly for service-based businesses, by the way, not if you're in a product-based business, but a service-based business, it's usually a small enough community that large business won't go after it. Large business can think me because they have tons of money. So even if they don't go about the process well, they can just keep dumping money into something. But 20,000 prospects is also big enough in a service-based business that there's ample space for me. So that's one measurement. The other measurement, too, is I look to see if there's anyone in the any competitors in the community. If I see no one, it makes me a little nervous because that means no one's proven this niche to be successful yet. Conversely, if I see dozens of competitors in a very narrow niche, like 20,000 prospects, that's pretty saturated, actually. If I see one or two competitors, that's when I start salivating because they've proven this niche works, they've been sustainable on it, and there's ample space for me to elbow my way in.
And then, does this work in, you mentioned that B2C is not as, that's not as good of a marker. It works better in B2B. Is that what you...
Yeah, well, for that $20,000 number. So yeah, I actually own a B2C business for a manufacturer of leather products called Hedgehog Leatherworks. And in the B2C, I find the community has to be much bigger. It's much harder, by the way, to measure prospects. So we think we have about 500,000 potential customers, maybe a million. It's hard to measure. There's no online databases that talk about the community we sell to. But we also go through the same process. We look for competitors and see how saturated we believe the market is. And we also consider our offering. Are we really distinct? Are we offering a new flavor of something? I would argue, like, you know, the shoe market, every shoe on this planet you think would have been made, you think the shoe market is saturated, but then comes companies like UGG and Croc and Vibram with the five-finger shoe. They have such a distinct product that they open a brand new market for themselves.
So after Pumpkin Plan came Profit First, is that right?
Yep.
Now, So was that, you mentioned that a lot of these things come from your own struggles. Was that something that was spurred by you, like, lost focus, or you weren't making it when you were implementing the Pumpkin Plan philosophy?
Yeah. So, when I had my first couple of businesses, those tech businesses, they were growing rapidly, particularly the forensic investigation grew very rapidly. It became a very large small business within just a few years. But the shame behind it, or the struggle that I don't, you know, put out there on my CV, is the business wasn't profitable. I was refinancing my house to cover payroll. It was extraordinary stress and panic. So when I sold it, it wasn't just excitement of selling business. It was relief that I didn't have to manage this monster anymore. As I reflected back on that business and some of the other businesses I've had, well, from the outside, you know, multi-million dollar businesses, they look so great. But inside, it was pure stress and panic. I had to set out to fix that. I didn't want to live under that stress anymore. I had to figure out a way to be permanently profitable with all my businesses.
And then, so then that's where Profit First came from?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, when you see the when you built this community of profit first readers of your book, that was one part of it. Now it seems like you've, I don't know, on purpose or accidentally stumbled on this other side of profit first, where you have like a profit first certification.
Yeah. So what happened was somewhat by accident. And I think that's many how many businesses opportunities can present themselves. I wrote the first manuscript, circulated it with readers of some of my readers of my prior books, like Pumpkin Plan. And I remember the first call I got was a reader said, hey, I want to hire someone to do this. The irony is the entire process is laid out in Profit First. It's all in there. But some people say, I get it. I just don't want to do it myself. I want an accountant or a bookkeeper to just do this for me. Who do you know, Mike? And when I heard that, who do you know, Mike? I'm like, oh my gosh, here. Well, when I got the second call like that, I was convinced there was a business. And today we have 240, 250 people certified in Profit First. There are accountants and bookkeepers that are doing this all over the globe too.
Now, when you're building out that type of a community and that type of an organization, what were some of the things that you had to consider now? Because this now is, you know, it's a Russian nesting doll. It's in the sense yeah. that now somebody else is doing kind of what you were recommending. So how do you like yeah. hold them? How do you vet them? How do you hold them accountable? And how do you make sure they're doing it the way you would like them to do it?
Yeah. And that's been part of the challenge of our growth is the vetting process is very important because they're representative of the brand. You know, they are all distinct businesses, but they do represent the brand. So one is to get their history. I think history of service is indicative of future service. The second thing is we reserve the right to remove members. So when someone becomes certified, they have to sustain it. So and sadly, in very few, but we've had to actually remove certifications from people because they weren't upholding the brand and servicing it properly. I think one of the biggest things we do that is unique in ensuring the integrity of Profit First being served properly is everyone that joins our organization must implement Profit First in their business fully. We actually audit the business. We test the business to make sure that they're living the principle. To me, it's like a doctor. If a doctor is smoking a cigarette and drinking a cognac in front of you saying, you got to stop smoking, stop drinking, it's really hard to digest that prescription when she's smoking and drinking in front of you. When they're living the lifestyle and saying, this is the lifestyle you should live, it's much more palatable. And so that's what we have our members do. They have to live it. They have to believe it. It has to be servicing them before they can go out and serve others.
Now, did you set this up as a franchise?
No. It's a licensing.
And then was that purpose or what was the rationale behind that?
Yeah. So a very close friend of mine owns a franchise called 1-800-GOT-JUNK, a guy named Brian Scudamore. And I talked to him about the process of franchising. And while intriguing, it is requires significant business sophistication and compliance. And it was just outside of what I wanted to do. So we thought licensing was the best way to go.
And it was outside of your superpower. So you passed.
We're far outside my superpower, yeah.
So now when you're going about growing this business, how do you get the word out, to get on the radar? Is it just come organically from fans of the book?
Yeah, so, you know, we're actively out there. I am very fortunate to be speaking constantly. So the speaking circuit is big. Readers of the book. And what's interesting is as an entrepreneur will read the book, they may love the accountant or bookkeepers they're working with. I'm finding they're turning their established accountant or bookkeeper onto Profit First saying, I want to keep working with you, but you got to do this.
Oh, I love that. He has a radio show too. Mike has a radio. You have a radio show, right? Or
yeah,
a podcast?
Well, a podcast.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I started podcasting about 4 years ago, and what I did was I listened to some of the favorite radio shows I have, which are kind of like these morning zoo radio shows. So we have a morning show or morning zoo radio show around profitability, and it's a little bit like a blend of entertainment and education, but it's working. It's working.
And then so that's targeting the small to mid-sized business owner. To just educate them
That targets the entrepreneur, guides them to profitability from all different perspectives,
so
not
now,
just the profit first method.
When you're this can help us here at Business Radio X, and maybe you have some thoughts on this. When you're talking about niches of 20,000, are you defining entrepreneur, small business person? Are there different definitions in your mind of how you're picturing that in order to get to that 20,000 in niche?
Yeah, I mean, what I do is I think really B2B service when I do that 20,000 number for an assessment. And I look at a business community based upon its size. So, for example, I'd say, I want to sell to accountants. That's my prospects, actually, for Profit First Professionals. And I'll say, I want to work with accounting firms that do at least $500,000 in revenue, up to $5 million in revenue. That's who I'm targeting, how many of them are out there. And when I find that the number hits around 20,000, I feel comfortable. And I have flexibility. If it's 30 or 40,000, I still run my assessment. If it's only like 1,000 people, way too small. If it's 100,000, there's probably a larger company that's trying to move into that market.
Now, when you're kind of going about your process, is it the books are like you're learning, you're actually practicing what's happening in the books, and then you're writing about it after? Like, because, you know, after Profit First came Surge, and then I know you have a new book coming out.
Yeah.
So what I do is I first
present the challenges. What are the challenges I'm facing? And business readers that reach out to me and say, hey, on my own podcast, they'll come out and say, here's the new challenge I'm facing. I then research that and say, is this a problem that I've also experienced that I can relate to? If so, then I'll say, well, what are the solutions, and start researching it out and come up with hypotheses. Finally, these hypotheses will turn into a thesis, a belief solution. And then what I do is I test it first on my own business. If it's successful, then I will invite in other people to test it. So Profit First, I had about 100 different companies go through it. Once it worked for them, I said, now we got something, and made a book out of it. All in all, it takes me about 5 to 6 years to write a book. It's a long process, but I think it produces the right result.
What's an example of a thesis that failed?
I think the pumpkin plan went through about 6 iterations, and I think I can't think of the exact reasons it failed, but once I tested out, it's like, oh, it wasn't working consistently. It worked for one person but not another. And I said, oh, it's off the table. And it's painful to do that, but I have to put it off the table and rewrite it. Profit First, it took me probably about 7 iterations to get to where it is. It did kind of work from the get-go, but it was too complex. It got people confused. And I had to keep on refining it.
Well, I'll tell you, for me, the ultimate evidence that you are genuinely serving people here is that you have the end user, the business people out there in the marketplace, going to their provider, their accountant, and converting them, or at least opening their mind to the system. I mean, Lee, that would be like us having listeners out there in the marketplace going to people who they do business with and saying, if you really want to serve me and my ecosystem, then you need to underwrite a Business Radio X series or show. Right. I mean, that is the ultimate accomplishment. So congratulations. And I got to tell you, that is, I mean, we should be focused on a pursuit like that. I want to ask you in a little bit about the stuff you're doing to help folks with kids too. I saw you got a Profit First Kids, but this to me is very inspiring that this can be done, where you can actually have that end user going to the people who are trying to serve them and say, look, here's how you can help me, is use this.
Maybe that'll be a new book.
I love that.
No, I do like that. Yeah, empowering the community itself.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, tell me about this. I'm looking at some of the resources you have on the website, and you've got a ton of stuff. I mean, anyone who really wants to become a student of this could dive right in. But one of the things that struck a chord here is you've got a Profit First Kid. So you've put some thought into using this to help children and their parents as well then, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the... I think it translates to it translates into so many different ways, into so many different applications. But you know, that thesis actually isn't fully played out yet. That the application to our family lives. I'm actually testing it with my family. So I have children. We're testing out the system, and I see how it goes. But as I find new stuff, I do put on my website to get people to garnish, you know, the feedback of others. Is it working for them?
Well, I'll tell you this, for whatever it's worth, at our home, we were influenced early on to pay ourselves first. And you were speaking about open books earlier. And we had a lot of friends that just thought we were crazy. But when my kids, both the young ladies, they're 20 and 25 now. But when they were teenagers, we kind of ran an open book household. And, you know, we had, money in pouches in the drawer. And they knew that in the miscellaneous envelope, you know, had $100 in it or whatever. They had access to it, but they also, our friends thought we were crazy. You know, well, you know, they're just going to steal the money or whatever. And no, and they knew they could spend it all in one Friday night. And they knew that, you know, for the next 3 weeks, there wasn't going to be any money in that pouch. Maybe it was luck, but I got to tell you, Holly and I are so delighted that we felt like it worked incredibly well. And we feel like we have two young ladies who have a very healthy relationship with money. So for whatever that's worth, I hope you continue to develop more resources and conduct more research on the family front with some of this stuff.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I've had inquiries coming in about that. I hope to get to it too. It's definitely on the docket. The question is when will I have it really perfected and when we'll be ready? But it does work. It does.
Now, how much of the problem for a business owner is kind of this archaic general accounting principles, processes that have historically, maybe they're built for larger firms that just aren't as relevant to small businesses and entrepreneurs?
I think it's pretty pervasive. I think a tremendous amount. And it's not that it doesn't work. It does work. It's too complex and gets ignored. So most business owners that I've met and interviewed and talked with will revert to what I call bank balance accounting. They know they should read an income statement, tie that into a balance sheet, a cash flow statement. They should know their metrics, their operating cash ratio, and they should know the KPIs and all these different things. And it's all over their head, including mine. And so we revert to bank balance accounting. Do I have money in my bank or not? If I do, I spend it. If I don't, I don't. And that's why I developed Profit First. It's inherently in their natural path. What I did is I observed, what was I doing? What do entrepreneurs typically do? And they log into their bank accounts to see if they have money. So Profit First is set up to be at the bank. So when you log in, you instantly know what envelopes, using that term we use, what envelopes is money reserved for, and with money pre-allocated to its purpose, you use your money much more appropriately.
Now, do you have like any app or website kind of that portal where there's a QuickBooks version of this, where there's a Profit First version of QuickBooks, or that it lays on top of QuickBooks?
Yeah, not yet. Definitely something in the works, but nothing I can reveal yet.
Now, you talk about a Frankenstein formula in your book. Can you talk a little bit about
right.
that?
Yeah, so that was the original formula I talked about, where the traditional formula is sales minus expense equals profit. And I call it the Frankenstein formula because it creates you bring a business to life, you stitch it together, you have this amazing idea. Miraculously, your business now has legs and is moving, but now it becomes this all-consuming, soul-sucking monster. It doesn't stop chasing you, the founder of this business. And that formula keeps us stuck there. Most entrepreneurs I know who follow the traditional formula of profit coming last, waiting for the end of the year to cross their fingers and hope there's profit, are refinancing their house, you know, 3-4 times in a lifetime just to cover payroll or rent. And it's just a matter of time before that dream of a business becomes now a resentful relationship, ultimately a nightmare.
When in your history and your career, you've opened and you've run several businesses, and it seems like they're not there's not a kind of a thread tying them together. They're where your interest kind of changes. There's some elements of it, I guess, that you pulled from different things that are interesting you at the moment, or it's evolved. Can you talk about like where health and fitness has kind of joined the mix into this gumbo of adventures you've kind of accumulated?
What I found is for me, initially, the businesses I got into were based upon my vocation experience. So I had experience in technology and computers, and that's how I got started. But ultimately, I found that I have a very clear purpose that I've defined for myself. And I believe that it can be served through multiple vocations. And so when I see an opportunity present itself, I grab onto it. It's similar to this concept of pivot, which actually I have a little bit of disdain toward that term. Pivot says the concept is when a customer has a specific need, address it. And if their need changes or it's not how you assumed it to be, keep adjusting to what the customer wants. But that alone is chasing money. For me, I've defined a new term. I don't call it pivot. I call it align. And what I do is I look what the opportunity is in the market, what the customer needs, and I adjust to it. But at the same time, I make sure it's still congruent with my internal purpose. What gives me joy, how I think I can serve the world. And so while they look like all these disparate businesses, there's always this constant value of serving a community. And that's been very important to me, alignment.
Now, you've mentioned internal purpose several times. What is your internal purpose?
To eradicate entrepreneurial poverty. That's the term I use. And it almost sounds like a tagline, but I feel so compelled and called to do it. There's 83%, 85% of small businesses in this globe, and there's 128 million of us, are struggling and surviving check by check. There is countless entrepreneurs that are overwhelmed with stress and have no time to live life. Those are all different versions of poverty, financial poverty, time poverty, and I feel called to eradicate that. I've devoted my life to it.
And so you wake up every day trying to help the entrepreneur be profitable.
Yeah, have money, have time, have life. Serve a purpose.
And then part of that, at the heart of this, though, is you must have a belief that entrepreneurship is an important calling.
Oh, yeah. I think it's an important calling. I think it's the ultimate outlet. I mean, look at the two of you. You do something that you feel called to do that you're excited about, and you manifest. You've got this great radio show. I think entrepreneurship is the greatest platform for self-expression.
And for you, you have your books, you have your different ventures that you're on. We're talking primarily here about the Profit First and the Profit First certification for, is it bookkeepers and CPAs or is it only CPAs who can get this?
It's actually bookkeepers and CPAs. Yes, both.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to learn more about the Profit First kind of ventures and then all the other ones?
Yeah, so just Google Profit First. If you type in Profit First, we pretty much have the front page of Google. So you'll find the book, you'll find Profit First Professionals, the organization. And then if you want to learn more about me, my name is Mike Michalowicz. I realize it's the longest, most Polish name on the planet. There is a shortcut. My nickname in high school is Mike Motorbike. So if you go to MikeMotorbike.com, that'll actually bring you to my website and you get all the resources there for free.
Well, Mike, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show this afternoon, man. Keep up the good work. We're going to continue to follow your work, and we're going to be some of those voices out there encouraging not only the professionals who serve us, but those that we run into on a daily basis. Man, you got to get on. You got to get on board with this. This is fantastic, man. You made this a real pleasure.
Oh, I appreciate both of you gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor, our fearless producer, Katie Galley. Our guest today, Mike Michalowicz, author, speaker, and all-around just good guy. And everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.